Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the editors of what The New Yorker calls the Libertarian Bible assemble each Monday to preach freedom. Catherine, I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, and appearing in the studio together, I'm sorry, in the office together, not quite the studio together, but for the first time in a whole long time, is Peter Suderman and Catherine Mangue Ward. I hope you all brought your breath mints.
Howdy.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
We are going to do an absolute victory dance, a Gandhi dance of freedom. About masks.
The icky shuffle.
Absolutely the icky shuffle of freedom in a moment. But first, data privacy is now finally in your hands. Introducing Secure, the Swiss-hosted instant messaging and email platform. Trusted by privacy advocates across the globe, Secure offers 100% proprietary technology. Absolutely unaffiliated with Amazon, Google, or Microsoft. Your data is now completely in your hands, not big data's. Make the move to Secure today at secure.com. That's SEKUR.com. You'll be glad you did. Okay. 2 months after calling Texas Governor Greg Abbott, right? His name's Greg Abbott. Thank you.
Yes, not Greg Abbott.
A Neanderthal for revoking a mask mandate. President Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. Last week was suddenly all you can take your masks off if you got the jab, to which people in wide swaths of the country said, yeah, we know. But judging by the sidewalk traffic in New York over this glorious spring weekend, it's kind of nudged our masking numbers down to maybe like 50%. The CDC's super confusing color-coded mask, what you should do and what you should not do, that they unveiled like 2 weeks ago and we talked about here on this podcast, has now been redone and the whole side is basically green. Director Rochelle Walensky over the weekend said that, trying to explain these sudden changes, that the science really, really changed over the last 2 weeks about masking. Meanwhile, there's been some preliminary reporting that the CDC might walk some of last week's messaging back at least a little bit in some places, and everyone is continues to be mystified by their process and policies. We're going to definitely get into that mixed governmental messaging, but Catherine, you're the poet here of the Libertarian Bible. you're the what's the... I was going to say,
I have the least amount of poetry in my soul of any of the people on this podcast.
That's why I go to you.
Let's do it.
Can you wax poetical?
That's because you don't have a soul.
Good point.
Look, even robots.
Can I wax poetical about what?
Dream of electric salvation. Can you wax poetical about how nice it is to see Peter's beard and how lovely it was to feel the breeze on your cheeks?
I genuinely am enjoying the breeze on my cheeks. Wow, that sentence. Miss people's faces, even though I don't like people. I am, in general, I need a lot of clues to be able to successfully socially interact with people, and I've been deprived of a lot of those clues. And so I really appreciate having more data now. That is a number one benefit of mask wearing. We actually talked about this a while back, that neuroatypical humans, perhaps some subset of those people suffered most from the masking. Our poor children are still suffering from the masking in that way. I guarantee you that, you know, the idea of trying to teach a class full of second graders with a mask on is still deeply challenging. And so I look forward to some of that falling by the wayside, since, as we know, the CDC just wakes up every morning and starts fresh. So as far as I'm concerned, like tomorrow, we might get like a whole nother grid where it's like, actually, vaccinated people should wear masks and unvaccinated people shouldn't. And also like ponies should wear masks. I mean, at this point, if confidence in the CDC was not already very, very low, and we know that it is, this about face would further undermine it. I, however, I'm going out and about touting the CDC guidance this time around because it's the finding I like. And I think that that's something we should talk about, right? Like, I for sure have been like, oh, I'm so excited to see you. The CDC says that we can take our masks off. Let's chat. And like, I recognize fully the hypocrisy of doing that. But if that's what gets people's masks off, which I believe is now the appropriate and scientifically literate thing to do, then so be it.
Yeah, my 12-year-old.
It's a little like the online role-playing games or the online shooters where the developers are constantly slightly tweaking, like not just the interaction rules, but like which guns work best and worst, right? And so they will buff certain items or nerf certain items. That means either power them up or power them down in order to change the meta. And so people who are really good at these games have to get not only good at the mechanics of the game, but at learning how to adapt to changing rule sets.
Oh
my God.
I'm amazed.
Aren't we all just adapting to changing rule sets?
It's also actually what running a publication is like if you're trying to push your content out on social media at this point. Like they're constantly buffing and nerfing different.
Social media is the worst.
Facebook is always changing the meta.
Nick, let's change our metas. Last time I saw you, Nick Gillespie, we were indoors, we were mask free, you were wearing tassels. Yeah. We were
fringe. On what?
Fringe. Yeah, you know what? What stays in Chinatown, right. You know, what happens in Chinatown stays in Chinatown.
And we're talking about Todd Rundgren.
Except for flu.
And how much you love the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame now. Is your VX Day celebration muted or even strangled by white hot libertarian rage at the mistakes and mixed messaging that got us thus far?
And I am looking forward to what I think should be the first big kind of Broadway show. It should be done live in Times Square, and it should be a version of Quadrophenia where the mods and rockers are maskers and anti-maskers.
Oh my God, that's brilliant.
Thank you. It's a pretty good idea.
I mean, SNL's cold open this weekend, and I don't know why I'm watching SNL again.
Why do you do that?
Or I was actually the clips, because someone said like SNL was good this weekend, so I looked at the clips and it wasn't. It was a
who was the guest?
Doesn't matter. But the cold open with
Keegan
somebody
Michael
playing was I believe Kate McKinnon. I want to say playing Dr. Fauci.
Then they were trying out, this is relevant to Nick's Quadrophenia thing, it was a bunch of doctors, but who were frustrated theater geeks trying out different theater-like improv scenarios about how to sell the CDC's new recommendations. And frankly, Nick, yours is better than all of them.
The entire, COVID response from the CDC and the FDA has been one fiasco after another. And in a way, you know, this is like the perfect capper, assuming that it doesn't change, as Catherine was suggesting, you know, by the end of this, by the time this podcast goes live, we may be living under a new lockdown. And I want to, I talk a lot about how, you know, the ways that when authority is revealed as completely either incompetent or, you know, ambiguous or just whatever, it drives down confidence in society. We don't want to live in a low trust society. At this point, the past couple of months and the past couple of weeks have been so flagrant in people who are in authority positions with a capital A, totally speaking out of their ass, that I think this may be the thing that gets us to hop, skip, and jump over the river Styx and like just be like, okay, you know what? We need to be we need to be sovereign individuals in a way that doesn't mean like crawling into a bunker somewhere in Texas and, you know, waiting for the rapture. Authority is over, man. Let's start living as real rational people, semi-rational people who can get along and, will insist on things passing the bullshit detector before we vote them in into office or follow it.
Suderman, to that point, the last 2 weeks, the last 2 months, the last 2 years, kind of permanently discredited the you can't handle the truth approach to public health. Shouldn't it now just be obvious that you say what you know and what you don't know and you trust people to do the things?
That was so endearing, Matt.
Me and Rumsfeld, man.
Articulate, yeah.
Yeah, I think they should be honest with us. At the same time, I think there's a deeper problem, which is that we have vested so much cultural authority in the CDC, which even if they were telling us what they thought they knew and what they didn't and what they thought they didn't know at any given point, would have been wrong in many instances, and they would have not been able to express it, I think. I think it's just very difficult, even if they're really, truly trying, but they wouldn't be even be able to try, even if they wanted to. I think they would have a hard time saying, this is what we think right now, but it's subject to change. And that's the kind, that is, if they're really being transparent and honest, what they need to be saying is, this is basically where we think the science is at, and these are our guidelines. But
why would it be hard for them to say that?
Because an institutional body like that cannot constitutionally express uncertainty. And they're just sort of unable to do it. And I'm not saying it's not humanly possible. I'm saying it's not institutionally possible for a government agency that thinks of itself as the authority on these issues. And so they have a sort of a characterological flaw, which is that they don't know how to communicate uncertainty to the public. And in fact, the last 15 months have been nothing but uncertainty. And the CDC inside itself is uncertain quite a bit. And when I mean some people in the CDC will be quite confident about what we know at any given point. And some people will say, well, I'm not sure we know that, because the CDC isn't just Rochelle Walensky. It's not just one person. It's a whole bunch of scientists, who some of whom are going to agree with us more, some of whom are going to disagree with us more, but all of whom think that the CDC's job is to say what we can definitively know at any given point. And the thing that we learned over the last 15 months is that the CDC, at least, doesn't definitively know much of anything at all. And when they think they do, they are often wrong. Now, in this case, like Catherine, I think that this guidance is correct, but I don't think it's correct because the CDC told us that it's correct. I think it's useful that the CDC came and said, hey, this is the guidance, because their guidance does have, it doesn't have direct power over policy, but it has a huge amount of influence. And you saw that with governors and mayors changing their policies immediately in some cases. I mean, within 24 hours after the announcement last week. So I think this is good in terms of giving us better outcomes. But I just think that we're sort of making a fundamental mistake in treating the CDC as the arbiter of what is true about public health at any given moment, because a thing we know is that they have been consistently wrong, not just for the last year or the last 2 years, but for the last 30 or 40 years about all manner of subjects that they have weighed in on with great confidence, saying this is the science at the moment, even when it has been often quite clear, and they have ended up changing in many cases years later their recommendations, despite the fact that people who are actually informed and sort of keeping up for themselves, because they have some reason to, have looked and said, look, this is crazy, this is not right. Or maybe it's right for some people, but it's not right for everyone. And that's the other problem here that I'll just add at the end is, they make recommendations that are one size fits all for everyone, and that's bad.
You know, one of the things that is interesting, if you go back and look at even critics of government, say somebody like Philip K. Howard of the Common Good Foundation and whatnot, he would point to the CDC as an exemplary government institution that actually got the job done well. In his most recent book that came out about a year or two ago, he talked about how part of the reason for that was that the CDC was not headquartered in Washington, so that it was not captured by the kind of, you know, beltway consensus or bubble thinking. But, you know, we need then to have an understanding and an appreciation. You know, we're not going to get rid of the CDC, nor should we get rid of certain types of large government institutions. But we do need to have a different orientation towards all of this, and one that proceeds not from kind of being a random, you know, jerk-off troll, but from being an adult, you know, semi-autonomous individual and citizen, where you are given, you know, what is known to be the truth. Peter, it might be that they're not going to do it, but, you know, somebody like Anthony Fauci, not, you know, the CDC, but he explicitly has talked about how much he dissembled and lied over the course of the pandemic. And we assume that that same kind of behavior tick is absolutely, you know, rife throughout all of the people in authority. And those authorities, like, they need to answer for where do they get off, like, fucking lying. I mean, it's like it's Dr. Zaius's all the way down, where they're hiding the secret truth, the dark, dark truth. you know, because we can't handle it. It's like, fuck you, go to China if you're going to do that.
At the very beginning of this, I want to say in early March of last year, possibly even the last time I recorded the podcast from the office, I delivered a little bit of a rant about how the public health community is all about behavioral control, and that's just what they do. And I went through like many revolutions of thought, as you all heard, over the last year about public health and about behavioral sort of controls and restrictions and what was good at any given time and what we could know. And in the end, I've sort of landed back at basically the same place, which is the public health mindset is that their job is behavioral control for the population and for individuals. And that's what they think their job is to do. And so that's how they go about making recommendations and talking about science and talking, right? They don't talk about science sort of saying this suggests we that some people in some cases should do some things. What they do is they say, look, here is the one size fits rule for everyone. You have to change your behavior. And ideally, government authorities would mandate it. And we've been through a really extreme version of that for the last year or so, and it has just been a disaster.
Catherine, is there an element of this, looking at mask politics in particular, where, like, yes, the CDC has screwed that up so many times it's hard to keep count, but also that, like, our consumer need to make tribal politics out of all of this also plays in here. I'm thinking in terms of like the Grim Reaper on beaches in Miami, mask burning, you know, protests in Idaho or Montana, wherever the hell that was. Rachel Maddow went on, I sent you guys a clip this past week, like, you know, just admitting that it's going to be hard now after the CDC to not walk outside and look at people who don't have masks and immediately conclude that they're Trumpies trying to kill you. She's like, she was like, wow, I'm gonna have to rewire my brain.
Yeah, that clip is from 2002, Matt.
So how much of this is on us, or is that what I've just pointed out itself, just kind of like Twitter bubble, and most people are normal and don't walk around making gigantic collective demonization conclusions based on someone's choice to put cloth on their face?
I mean, one problem with living and working in DuPont Circle in Washington, D.C. is that my real life is not so dissimilar from a Twitter bubble. Like, I can't yeah. fact check Twitter by going outside of my house and like talking to people and seeing people in the world, because those people are the people on Twitter. So I don't know, actually, what's going on in the real world as usual. But I will say that I've actually been thinking a lot about this point that you just raised, the tribalism thing, partially because I'm always thinking about that. And you know, this is many people have had this thought, but I sort of mentally credit it to Jonah Goldberg, the idea of the tribe for liberty. And like, how can we harness this absolutely poisonous, deep human thing of just wanting to be part of a tribe and wanting to hate the other tribe and do everything in our power to oppose the other tribe? And can we somehow figure out how to like use that to create a tribe of people who hate people that want to tell them what to do or something? Like, I just keep thinking about that because, yeah, like the mask has slipped, so to freaking speak, about the tribalism of mask wearing. Sorry. Because
don't be sorry.
People are just cheerfully saying out loud, I'm wearing a mask because I think it tells people that I am not MAGA-ite. And that's crazy. That is a crazy thing to say. That is cuckoo bananas. Like, that's not at all what the mask. If you want to tell people you're a Biden voter, get a button and take off your mask. Like, get a t-shirt, get a bumper sticker that says coexist. Like, there are ways that allow your face and my face to talk to each other to signal your political tribalism. And it is, I mean, I would like to think I am above tribalism. I would like to think I am better than that. I'm clearly not. And I know that because I am a human. And so therefore, I am absolutely subject to all of these same problems. But this subspecies of tribalism paired with the need to insist on the lingering need to insist on the noble lie, which is what we were just talking about with the CDC, the sort of like, well, you have to tell people you have to keep wearing your mask in order to signal to the rubes that they should keep wearing their masks because they are too ignorant to understand that they need to get vaccinated or something, is now how that cascade goes. And it sucks. It sucks and I hate it.
Nick, today in New York's...
I do want Trump to, his ultimate troll move, which I would vote for him.
Again.
You know, I'll write him in 2024 if he suddenly says, you know what, I'm wearing masks.
Oh my God, it would fully invert.
I know that all of this stuff, if the CDC is against it, then I'm for it.
We know this about all kinds of politics, right? Like Americans right now are saying, particularly at the end of the Trump administration, were saying that they were pro-free trade and pro-immigration in record-setting numbers, not because they were, but just because Donald Trump wasn't. And this just keeps happening over and over. Like, don't let that man be in charge of us still. We don't gotta.
Yeah, the CDC is in charge.
Not in charge anymore.
He's living rent free right on our face, like the that
eviction.
Thing
there's
from
eviction
the
moratorium, so everybody can live rent free in our heads.
Nick, today is the first day in 14 months that you can ride the subway for 24 consecutive hours. So at any time of the day, you can see, as I did on Saturday,
which is something, by the way, that Lee Harvey Oswald used to do back in the day. Famously.
Deep cut. So you can see men urinating on platforms, as my 12-year-old daughter did.
Any time of day.
This was, of course, done in the name of wiping down surfaces to prevent the transmission of COVID, which we have known since last April was kind of not a thing. So what are some, as you look around, as you gaze upon the fruited plain of Chinatown and Soho, or wherever the hell you live, what are some of the regulations, rules, hungover restrictions that you are eager to see lifted, or even just practices you would like to see stopped?
You know, it's hard to say. I hate the ritualized thing, which now seems like almost like a religious thing of going into restaurants and having my temperature taken by looking at my wrist. And these are the things that I also think about. They're already starting to fade, like a bunch of stores in New York, Matt Welch, and you probably have seen this, or in any city, on the sidewalk where people spray painted like little feet, things 6 feet apart. And I'm thinking, like, you know, in another 10 years, maybe it might even be like 6 months, but people will be like, what the fuck was that? Was that some kind of promotion for shoes or for Dr. Scholl's? Like, oh, you remember that Dr. Scholl's orthotics thing or something?
I kind of want to get like a spray gun full of, like, I don't know, Goo Gone or whatever would like get those things up and just start kind of vigilanteing around in the city. Like, that would actually be a real community service.
It will be fascinating to see how quickly a lot of the brutal parts of the lockdown disappear, but then the parts that, you know, kind of, remain somehow in place, but people forget quickly. There's a great book by an old historian called Alice Morse Earle called Strange Farm Implements of New England. And this, she was writing in like the teens or 20s, and she would go around to farms in New England and ask the farmers who had lived there and grown up there, like, what is that thing? And like in their lifetime, they were like, I don't remember what that was for.
Oh, wow.
You know, these rusting implements. And, you know, that's kind of a powerful thing, but, you know, but they're still there. You know, and there's so many elements of, you know, when the tide goes out on something. I mean, I think the UC system, at least into the 90s, and maybe it's still going on, you know, they were still having professors in the UC system, the University of California system, were doing loyalty oaths that were...
It's still on the books as far as I know.
Yeah, you know,
tried to fight that when I was an employee and it didn't work out.
That came out because you are a communist, right? You're the last mole in America, Matt
That's
Welch.
Right.
You're just...
Absolutely.
Now that you're working at the Libertarian Bible, the Vulgate, the Latin version, so it's not... You're playing us all. I know that.
He's waiting to be activated any minute now.
But it is just fascinating the way that, you know, these things linger on. You know, that is going to be interesting to see. John Mueller, the Ohio State political scientist and Cato adjunct scholar, has written about this again and again of how scares create all of these weird things. You know, and obviously an obvious one is the, you know, TSA and whatnot that just live on almost indefinitely to a point where you forget why this
that
fucking thing
your
started
farm implements thing just reminds me of the great 1970s game show Liars Club, which I highly recommend people go down a YouTube rabbit hole with. Suderman, what is a restriction, especially but not only a government restriction, that you would like to see removed yesterday, and how much of it is cocktails?
Well, in Washington, D.C., it's all of them because we are still, we have not updated anything in Washington, D.C. as a result of the CDC guidance on Thursday. There was an update a week or two before in which the city slightly increased capacity and laid out a plan to end all capacity limits by, I believe it is June 11th, though they were not at that time planning to lift mask restrictions. So, I mean, in D.C., I would like to see it move closer to, frankly, to New York at this point, which is much further along in reopening than Washington, D.C. is. But a very specific and small thing that I will point out that actually doesn't have anything to do with cocktails, though I would really, really like bar seating to be reopened, is the obsession with surface washing at gyms. So I've been able to go back to my gym after getting vaccinated, and you have to wear a mask, and you have to like check in to make sure, you know, you've got to check in advance through a computer system because they have capacity limits. You can't use the shower at the gym at all, right? So you're gonna walk out stinky no matter what. But in addition to this, they are now completely obsessed with spraying down every single surface that you touch throughout. And so there's like, this place is just covered in spray bottles of cleaner. And this is just, look, maybe you can say this is more sanitary and better overall, but it has nothing to do with COVID. There's, as we've talked about a zillion times here, there's just no reason to think that surface transmission is a meaningful vector for transmission. And yet every single bro in there is like grunting through his sets and then spraying and wiping down every surface within like a 8-foot radius of where he's been. And it's just sort of weird to watch everyone engage in this theater, especially since workout bros are kind of like body science people who pay a lot of attention to like, here's exactly what you need to do in order to, you know, maximize, right? To min-max your gains, right? Your G-A-I-N-Z. And every one of these people has to know that this is ridiculous. The gym owners have to know that this is ridiculous. But they've all collectively decided in conjunction with the gym rules that this has to be done in order to make people feel better.
Catherine, my version of hell for a long time has been what I imagined to be watching the movie Birds, which is something that's never going to happen. But I think I'm going to update that. And it'd be like being inside of Suderman's gym. That just sounds like awful. And it's not Suderman specific, to be clear, just
the one great thing about my gym specifically, but all gyms in Washington, D.C., is that people work out to C-SPAN.
No,
If you go through the aerobic exercise area,
send
like two-thirds
of the televisions
are two-thirds of the televisions are tuned to C-SPAN, and people are just like watching Orrin Hatch give a speech and like,
we need to stop Washington, D.C. until we can figure out what's going on. Yes, Kevin.
Thank you, Cable.
I tried to go to the gym like one time. Like I tried to join a gym one time in like 2003, and that was like the only time I've ever been in a gym. And I really tried. Like I got like my free month, and I like got some sneakers, and like I was like, I'm gonna go be a gym person now. And the like dystopian, stinky despair that you're describing is 100% what drove me away. Like it wasn't the physical exercise, which I don't mind. It was the milieu, the miasma of the gym. So like, yeah, hard no on COVID era gym, especially.
Catherine, before we go to break, take us out on a restriction that you would like to see lifted ASAP.
Yeah, I've actually two, but I promise to be fast. The first one is I am preemptively imagining a scenario in 2 weeks when they open the pools where people are masking on pool decks and then getting into the pool without the mask and then getting back out of the pool and putting on a wet mask. And it is going to be so dumb that I am already furious about it. But the thing I want to get rid of now,
I believe the DC regulations for right now actually say that you, on the one hand, are required to wear a mask on the deck, and you are prohibited
from
wearing
one. That's what's going to happen.
Pool.
It's going to be so freaking dumb. And now add to this, already, like, maneuvering children at the pool is, like, they're just, like, slippery little jerk faces to begin with, and now, like, try to put masks on their slightly sunburned ears. No, the thing I want to get rid of is my children, every single day, have to take a Xeroxed sheet of paper with them into the school building on which I have written the date and then no, no, no for like fever, whatever, whatever, and then signed it. And this morning, between my house and the school, which is three blocks, my son lost his. And it was like, it was, you can get another one. And da, 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 da. Those papers are not protecting anyone from COVID. And they are making my mornings way worse. And we are going to do them every day until the end of the school year. There is no way that is going to change. And that is unfortunate.
We do that in New York. But instead of the paper, they want you to just download the app and put all your information.
Please give me an app. I beg you for an app.
You can use the app. Well, we don't do it in the Welch household for privacy reasons. But they instead, just, they ask you at the door. The same four questions, and they ask them in like, blah, 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 and you say, yeah, 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 and then you're in.
But so did you have a fever?
No.
Sure.
Did not have.
Are they asking, like, Matt, did Houston win the American League or anything? Are they?
They're not checking my commie mold status.
I had a fever, and the only cure was more cowbell.
Yeah. The only fever is Dr. Johnny, as Nick and I know. The next frontier in a lot of the CDC guidance and how it affects people in blue states, which is kind of where the stuff happens, is mask wearing at summer camps. Robbie Suave has written about this reason. The current guidance is that, oh yeah, two-year-olds totally need to wear masks outside at summer camps, which is insane and it's so bad and so wrong.
Look, you've got to create a lifetime of misery. That's what summer camp is for, right? And, you know, now that we live in the post-wedgie era where you're not allowed to physically bully kids, you know, you've got to do it psychologically, man.
I look forward to anything that speeds up the removal of masks from my six-year-old. Just doesn't need them, still wears them too often.
Why don't you throw your body on the machine, Matt? Why don't you take a stand and ruin your child's life by making them an example of freedom?
Now that you put it that way, that sounds interesting. We're going to continue the conversation about CDC guidance, masks, and other things here in a moment with a listener mail. But first, is your mental and emotional well-being dragging you down, preventing you from experiencing happiness or achieving your goals? You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable and get instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states and maybe even Washington. BetterHelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what Randy Weingarten receives weekly from the New York Times, has helped more than 1 million people take charge of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10% off your first month. BetterHelp.com is more affordable than traditional online counseling services. Financial aid is available, and soon, hopefully, your depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, whatever, will be behind you. Go to the website BetterHelp.com/Roundtable. Describe your issues and desires, and you'll be set up with someone to talk to within 24 hours. Please do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder, send all your queries to roundtable@reason.com via electronic mail. This one comes from Matt Rundle, who writes, why is it that no one seems outraged by the fact that the new CDC guidance for fully vaccinated people creates two fundamentally different classes of citizens, the fully privileged vaccinates and the indefinitely rights suspended unvaccinates, who, of course, are required to publicly self-identify by wearing a specific and highly visible garment, partially obscuring their identity, no less, as if those who are not allowed to participate fully in society should also continue to be without a certain degree of individual physical identity. Even within a recent post-guidance piece at Reason.com, the only commentary directed toward the unvaccinated was simply get vaccinated. If the vaccines work, then those who want their protection have it, and those who don't have chosen to accept whatever risk is associated with being unvaccinated, with the efficacy of the vaccines protecting, without question, those who have received it, and there being no need for fear of the pestilence of the unvaccinated. Is the cultural stratification created by the new CDC guidance not as anti-libertarian as public policy gets, Catherine Mengu Ward?
Yeah, there's like a couple of different actors lurking in that question, which I'd like to disaggregate. So there's the cultural stratification question, right? And then there's also the legal question of what people can and can't do. The CDC actually has done, among a whole year of doing a bad job of things, it has also done a bad job of communicating when it is creating guidelines and when it is creating binding strictures in some cases. You know, this is a case where I think it would be overwrought to say the unvaccinated will no longer be a rights-bearing population. I do not think that is what is happening here. I do think people should get a vaccine. And I do think the argument eventually being non-vaccinated is largely a cost that you impose on yourself and can accept on your own token. But we are in a transition period where we still have massive externalities from a global pandemic, which is, you know, they are dropping. The externalities are dropping. Like, as more people get vaccinated, there is less risk in the general population. And it makes sense that we should change rules and change behaviors based on the reflection of that risk. That, by the way, is, I think, the most charitable interpretation of these people who were like, in the last 2 weeks, the science changed. It is true that infection numbers and death numbers continue to drop. And so you could say, listen, we are getting closer to something that looks like herd immunity. We are getting closer to a situation where we can tolerate people taking more risks as a general population because it is less likely to redound on innocent people or non-actors. But in this case, yes, it would be unlibertarian if we created a vast legal regime that, you know, required a vaccination card in every public venue forever and ever. It would not be unlibertarian for me to ask you to wear a mask in my restaurant if you were unvaccinated. And I really believe in that distinction. I really think it is an important core distinction of libertarianism. And when you say cultural divide, when you talk about sort of a cultural question here, I just think there's going to be gray area. And I don't like wearing masks. I think people should get vaccinated. And there's just going to be a transition period here where private actors can make their own decisions and should feel free to require masks for those who are unvaccinated.
Nick, there's in addition to people who kind of just don't want to get vaccinated for whatever reason, there are plenty of immunocompromised people or people who have medical reasons to not get vaccinated. Are they not wrong to feel a sense of not even preliminary, but just sort of current fear at these kind of structures? You got, you know, go to baseball games, there's supposed to be a vaccinated and unvaccinated section. I don't know if Suderman has to flash his vax card at the gym or whatnot. I know that the Libertarian Party, in its kind of endless internal divisions over various things, there's been arguments over messaging that certain state parties have done, in which they compare the vaccinated, unvaccinated to segregated drinking fountains there. What say you?
That's a keen observation.
Is it?
You know, I mean, because the people always making that argument somehow, you know, 5 minutes later are defending the Confederacy. So I just, you know, within a, that's a kind of cloud cuckoo land.
But to not necessarily defend the messaging, but defend the kind of argument embedded underneath it. If we are, you know, the CDC, which controls evictions,
right,
crying out loud.
And, not anymore, but yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, has influence on laws that are made. And to the extent that laws are leading to a kind of a government encouragement of what amounts of vaccine passports, isn't that like a fundamental, let's take the libertarian stand right now against all that?
Yeah, I think, you know, what is really meaningful here ultimately is whether or not there is a legal regime that comes into place that is like, you have to be vaccinated to do this, you know, at a basic root level of society or of politics and governance. That hasn't happened yet. And I think we should push back against that. I don't like the idea of vaccine passports. You know, to go back to what Peter was talking about, I don't like the idea of public health. This, you know, and if you go back and read Foucault's Discipline and Punish, he talks about the rise of statistics in, I guess it's like 18th century France. Like, once you have the government collecting certain kinds of data, the implication, you know, it's like the logic follows through that you are going to be controlling large populations as groups rather than giving over to what Friedrich Hayek would later talk about as individual methodological individualism as the proper course of political action as well as intellectual inquiry. So like I get all of that. I think, you know, we need to push back against the idea of vaccine passports in any significant way. And then there is a cultural battle where it is like, you know, where, and, you know, and libertarians, we're kind of, our tits are in a ringer here of constantly saying, you know, that like it's a private business like Facebook, like Twitter, like your local gym or whatever has near absolute rights to make you, you know, do the hokey pokey before you come in. But, you know, they shouldn't do it. Because like in this, I think the actual spirit of libertarianism is always about openness and about kind of pluralism and tolerance and like loosening restrictions on everything. But that's where we are culturally. And it's going to be, it's a good argument to be having because I think it sidesteps the, both the banality and the sterility and just the awfulness of politicizing every goddamn thing, including wearing masks.
I have to say, though, I mean, you and I have disagreed about this many times, but I'm going to disagree with you about it again here. I think that implicit in the libertarian idea that the state should be as minimal as possible and that private businesses should have near absolute discretion to, you know, choose what conduct they allow on their property or on their platform or however you want to say it. Like, I actually disagree when you say, but they broadly shouldn't. I think the way we get society to work mm-hmm. is that sometimes they should. Now, I think we should have a robust conversation about when they should. I think lots of platforms and individuals and property holders and corporations get it wrong. But I think there has to be an arbiter somewhere. And if the arbiter isn't the state, then it should be, it should hopefully be like a polycentric order where we have lots of arbiters and you can choose who to do business with and engage with. I think to say,
but I agree.
Think when you say our broad, it is incumbent upon libertarians to also encourage a broad cultural agnosticism about, for instance, mask wearing. Like, I disagree. I think it's incumbent upon libertarians to have very specific
more
views.
In terms of like when, you know, if YouTube or whoever can't withstand the dread presence of Count Dankula, you know, like that's a shitty society and YouTube has, you know, every right to do what it wants, but it's like, you know, you're going to stop going to people's houses who kick you out at a dinner party the minute you use the wrong fork. Literally.
I would just bring this back to actual practical policy questions.
Must you?
Yes. Yeah,
oh, God damn you, Peter.
Note that, first of all, the CDC guidance here is guidance. And the CDC isn't setting policy, right? So, so like I said, Washington, D.C. hasn't changed anything as a result of the CDC guidance. I think Washington, D.C. should. However, both Virginia and Maryland have changed their policies as a result of CDC guidance. And they've done it in different ways, which are telling. In Virginia, which has a Democratic governor, they've said, well, if you're vaccinated, you can now be inside without a mask in a bunch of basically the same circumstances that the CDC says. But in Maryland, which has a Republican governor, they've said you can be inside whether you're vaccinated or not. And so we have two different states, two different elected officials, and two different policy regimes based on the CDC guidance. And that also tells you something, I think, about this guidance, which is in the absence of a government-enforced vaccine passport system, which I don't know if I quite want to say to their credit, but to some small credit, the Biden administration has said pretty consistently they don't want to pursue it, at least at a federal level. And so in the absence of a government-built vaccine passport system, this is pretty unenforceable. And people who are not vaccinated are not going to, at least are not, there's not going to be a great way of distinguishing between vaccinated and unvaccinated people. And so while I don't love the CDC creating this two-tiered caste system that the questioner is asking about, I'm not as convinced, I'm not as worried, and I definitely don't think this is as anti-libertarian as public policy gets, in part just because we're not going to see it enforced even as the CDC, we're not going to see the CDC guidelines enforced as federal policy.
There's a moment in Mad Men, I think, after What's-Her-Face gets the abortion, where Don Draper says,
"Why are you erasing her?"
Because
what's her face gets an abortion, but then Don Draper.
Exactly right. Don Draper,
Peggy, Peggy, Olsen.
Peggy, like goes and fights because she sort of disappears and she's in a hospital bed somewhere or recovering. I don't know where. And he says, "I need you back." And then he like leans in and says something along the lines of, "It's amazing how soon this will not have happened," or something like that. Like, it's amazing how soon this will be over. This didn't happen. And it's more poetical than that. And sorry about that. And sorry for using the word poetical twice in this same podcast. Idea just being that I think pretty soon it's going to be amazing how much we forget about all this stuff. That like the masks will melt off. People outside of the city of San Francisco will not be glaring or yelling about this. The stickers are going to come off the sidewalk. Stuff's just going to kind of melt away a lot faster. I've never shown my vaccine card to anybody. I don't know where it is. I don't think that I'm going to have to, although maybe we'll see what happens when I attempt to travel to Europe later in the summer. But it's my hope, at least, that that a lot of this will go away so fast that even the questions and the very legitimate concerns that we have, you know, in mid-May of 2021 will look like science fiction by June, in the same way that Nick was talking about with farm implements.
By the way, there is, you know, the big precedent for this, the Spanish flu epidemic, suggests something along those lines, Matt, and particularly culturally. You know, and John Barry, who I interviewed for his fantastic biography of Roger Williams some years ago, around 2000, 2001, wrote this, you know, epic book about the Spanish flu epidemic. And one of the things that he marvels at is that in the 20s and afterwards, there are no songs, there are no plays, there are no paintings, there are no movies, there are no novels about the Spanish flu epidemic, which, you know, on a pound for pound basis was vastly worse than this, you know.
And I just wanted to, I agree very strongly with Nick about I think it's bad when the big social media companies like erase stuff or ghost stuff. I will make an exception to that. I think that YouTube should systematically go and scrub from all recorded history every one of those terrible like COVID related car commercials or any commercials like in the middle of the Grammys. You would have the little piano sadly tinking and it's been a really
in this difficult time.
I will jump through a window to choke that out system.
But you're right those are the first cultural artifacts that die. Like, those will disappear. We will forget that they existed. And I do think like we're gonna have, I think about 15 months from now, we're going to have a wave of bad COVID books, right? Like, it takes a long time to publish a book, actually. So we don't know yet what the COVID art will be, at least in book form. And there is going to be, it's going to be unpleasant when we have to review and think about and talk about the bad COVID books, which are all coming for us.
What do you think, though, about the psychological impacts of... I was at a gathering, a maskless gathering in Los Angeles, and a very well-known TV doctor was talking about, you know, kids between the ages of 8 to 15 are the ones that he worries about in terms of, you know, they've had a year and it will be, you know, ultimately be about 2 years of massive disruption and just kind of a shoveling of this kind of freeform anxiety into their formative periods, plus the disruption of school, et cetera. And I'm not even talking about like, okay, so every kid now is dumber than they were a year ago.
Though that's true.
Which goes against but it also goes against the argument that school is terrible. But in any case, but what are there deeper effects? And when I think back to the 70s and growing up, like, I don't remember anything about that, but there was a steady drumbeat of economic kind of near apocalypse that certainly filtered in. Matt, Gen X is famous for responding to, you know, when Robert Reed, the TV father of the Brady Bunch, dies of AIDS, you know, that's when the scales fell from the eye and they realized everything about America was fake. You know, I'm sure millennials have their versions of it, etc. Like, what is there going to be a psychological, you know, is there a psychological pig going through the python right now that will
The scales you know, are like self-regenerating. The scales are all constantly falling from new eyes. I actually saw, I was just like looking at the homepage of Reddit, and I saw a post from the Reddit for kids waiting for their college acceptances that was actually really striking and touching. It was like just a plea for people who care about college acceptances to think about how especially bad the kids this year, like the kids applying this year, had it. And I hadn't actually thought about this. So lots of people deferred from last year. So the available number of seats was way down at elite universities. And this is, you know, it's poor little rich kids problems, right? For sure. But the number of seats were way down at elite universities. And then all the universities constricted their wait lists. And many universities also just constricted the total number of spots. They wanted to reduce density in case this happens again. So there were just like fewer seats to be had, more kids from last year occupying those seats. And if you are, as many, many thousands of children and teenagers are in this country, a person whose whole life has been built up to, you got to get into a fancy college or none of this was worth it. The whole point of you is get into a fancy college. That sucks. That sucks for these kids. And it's like, these are the kids that are going to be out there at the absolute least making memes about how like late capitalism is bad and you shouldn't work. And at most fomenting whatever the next revolution is. And like, they're smart and they're not going to be busy getting drunk and like reading Aristotle. So they might like do things in the world. Now, maybe that's actually better than getting drunk and reading Aristotle. But I got to say, there are a few things in this world more fun than getting drunk and reading Aristotle. So I'm sorry for those kids.
Yeah. And it's not just elite colleges. Obviously, it's, you know, I know the kids babysitted ours who just deferred a year. She's going to McGill. McGill's fine university in Canada, but like tons of people just had their
deferred like dreams, a raisin in the sun.
You know, dreams deferred. I would not have been happy.
I've heard that sometimes having a dream deferred is like having it denied, in fact.
And it just really stinks. There's a really good and haunting piece, I believe, in New York Times Magazine over the weekend, or maybe just the paper itself, that dealt with just the terrible year for high school sophomores, and it's really haunting. I mean, now a lot of parents, it hasn't been great for my 12-year-old for sure. And there are ways that all of us worry about the imprint on them in a bunch of different behavioral ways. And you know, Alec McGillis has written some wonderful dark things for ProPublica, including about a kid who committed suicide down in the Southwest. About it, it's just been bad. I mean, you gear yourself up for whatever it is the next big thing, whether you're an athlete or whether it's just getting the hell out of your house, away from your parents. And it's bad. And also in this crucial time, you did the thing that, you know, too many of us journalists have done, which is that you've moved your life online, mediated by screens and the least kind of forgivable activity or cut and pastable like darknesses. It's bad. And it's, I think it's going to take some unlearning and hopefully, you know, the human body, just like the liver, as
one of my doctors. Infinitely replaceable. We're going to be having
one of my doctors once told me.
And infinitely divisible.
A marvelous organ. It regenerates despite everything that I do to it.
Despite what David Crosby has done to it.
We had a marvelous organ at my church growing up.
Speaking of bad jokes... wow. Let's go to our end of podcast. Well, it could be worse. Let's go to our end of podcast. What you have been consuming, Peter? What have you been tinkling on your marvelous organ?
Man, don't tempt me. I watched Army of the Dead, which is playing in a limited release now in theaters. It comes out on Netflix this coming Friday, so you can't watch it at home yet, but you will be able to quite soon. This is Zack Snyder's follow-up to Justice League and the Zack Snyder cut of Justice League. He's been busy making DC superhero movies for the last couple of years, but before that, he had made a pretty good zombie movie, a remake of George Romero's Dawn of the Dead, the one set in the shopping mall. And so Army of the Dead is not a sequel to that in direct terms, but it does a lot of the same things tonally. I don't think it is as good a movie. In fact, I think it is ultimately a movie that doesn't quite work. But it does have a kind of interesting libertarian-ish idea embedded in it, which is that crises that get turned into public health crises get used for political power grabs. And so the movie starts with a zombie outbreak that sort of ruins Las Vegas, which means, sadly, no more Freedom Fest in Las Vegas ever, not just this one year. But then they sort of take care of it and wall off the city. And so now you've got this kind of Escape from New York type situation where you've got a walled off, mostly destroyed Vegas that still has a zombie outbreak in the middle of it. And then right at the edge of the wall, you've got a quarantine zone for a bunch of basically disreputables that the government has decided we don't want these people interacting with society, even though they have absolutely no sign of infection. They've been like living there for weeks or months or a year or whatever, and they're fine. But you've also got these sort of public health cops walking around armed with temperature guns. And when people get unruly in these camps, or just when the cops, when these public health cops want to, say, take advantage of some of the women in the camps, they start to threaten them with, man, you wouldn't want a bad temperature gun reading, would you? Because that is a sign that, you know, maybe you're about to turn into a zombie, even though obviously that's not how zombieism works at all. There's a little, like, it's, in some ways, this is supposed to be, right? It's obviously, right? Yes,
I think we know this.
The Florida experiment has shown us pretty well. Yeah. So it's, like I said, it's not a great movie, but this idea that if you have a real crisis, what inevitably ends up happening is that it turns into an opportunity for a political power grab is surprisingly resonant right now. And it's kind of striking to see somebody with a badge and a gun carrying around a temperature gun and saying, look, if you fail this, or if you act belligerent, because belligerent actions are the first sign that you might be turning, you know, if you do that, then we have the power to basically, you know, to shoot you or whatever, because we think you're going to become a zombie and then become a public health menace. And so I don't know if I can quite recommend the movie on its own terms as a zombie movie, but as an idea about how crises work and how power grabs work, yeah, there's something to it.
Nick, what have you been zombieing out on?
I read a forthcoming book called Far From Respectable, Dave Hickey and His Art by Daniel Oppenheimer. And Dave Hickey is one of the most influential art critics of the past half century or more. He's probably best known for a book called Air Guitar, which is an essay about art and art and commerce, and also one called The Invisible Dragon. And Hickey, who is now in his 80s and is wheezing towards his demise, ultimately in New Mexico, he had been at UNLV for a long time, and he was, along with people like Robert Venturi and a couple of other early theorists of postmodern art and architecture, Hickey celebrated Las Vegas, and not in a cheap way, in a really profound way. Dave Hickey and Oppenheimer's book is this fantastic kind of appreciation of Hickey, that what Hickey did was he liberates art criticism and ultimately consumers, because he doesn't see a necessary conflict between commerce and culture. He kind of gets that these two things go hand in hand, and that consumers pull pleasure out of the art that they consume on the terms that they do it. But Hickey liberated us, you know, speaking kind of mythopoetically, from having a pre-existing set of aesthetics, mostly political, but oftentimes art-based, where, you know, that's how we judge whether or not something is beautiful. Does it fit like Aristotle's definition, or does it fit, Noam Chomsky's or something, you know, or Edmund Wilson's? And instead, it starts with the kind of pleasure and participation in the creation of meaning in the art. It's a profound, Dave Hickey is a profound figure in cultural politics, who many people might not know the name, but he is out there and he has changed an appreciation for cultural production much, much for the better. And this book, Far From Respectable, Dave Hickey and His Art, is just a great appreciation of Hickey, who himself is this bizarro, weird, fat guy from Texas who grew up uncultured and then became a major kind of creative force in how we think about what we like in art and culture.
Catherine, what do you like in art and culture this week?
A lot of stuff, but what I want to talk about is a podcast called The Great Antidote. And it is the podcast of Juliette Selgren, who is known to many of us as the daughter of Véronique de Rougy, Reason columnist and contributing editor. And her podcast is shaming every other podcast out there. She's a very nice young lady who I have met many times before, but who joined us for a dinner party this weekend in person, which was very exciting. And she...
Guys, in-person dinner parties
are
so great.
They're
and
a good
I always
thing.
Knew I enjoyed them, especially at Vero's house, but I cannot even tell you how much I realized how much I enjoyed them.
It was great. She's interviewed many people who you have heard on Nick Gillespie's interview podcast, but you know, she's a child, and the questions are genuinely good. It's not a gimmick. It's a podcast worth listening to. I listened to it in preparation for this dinner party, because when you go to a dinner party with a famous podcaster, you should listen to a few of their
Absolutely
episodes.
Correct.
And they're delightful. So The Great Antidote, if you like the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, you will almost certainly enjoy Juliette Selgren talking to many of these same people with a slightly different
and
twist.
Many of the people who have been on this podcast have been on her podcast as
All
well.
So indeed. True. Yes. Yeah, it was I had an absolutely wonderful time with her on a recent episode, and it's very wonderful and unsettling to be interviewed by a very whip smart person who you knew when she was five. it's just kind of a weird and wonderful thing.
Definitely one highlight of this dinner party was my husband quizzing Véronique's children about how we should raise our children. Like, he was like, okay, like, would you say your mom did this right or this wrong?
Oh dear God.
It was incredible. It was incredible. And Juliette and Véronique's other daughter as well had great answers.
Remind me to not bring my 12-year-old to the next Thanksgiving shindig of the in-laws.
It's happening. You're coming.
Well, the other one draws on the walls again. Speaking of the other one drawing on the walls and 6-year-olds and 5-year-olds, My What You is a children's book that I've recently put into the rotation.
Rainbow Fish.
Originally for the Don't Start. If you are
Giving
a
tree.
Person who has a 5, 6, 7-year-old who is constantly asking you math questions and calculations, and then which eventually all lead to, yeah, but what's infinity minus one?
Oh my God. Why do they all do that?
Every single one of them does that. So there's this great book called Infinity and Me. By Kate Hosford is the writer and the illustrator, because the illustrations are just lovely, dreamy, kind of steampunky, but pretty. Her name is Gabi Swiatkowska. I'm mangling that, but, you know, Polish. And it's just a great little exploration of a little girl who has big questions about what infinity means. And she tries to think it through and she learns about various aspects of it, but like can't quite wrap her head around it. And at the same time, she has nice red sparkly shoes and she wonders why no one's noticing them. And it's just a lovely, lovely book. And it doesn't stop the annoying 6-year-old from saying, yeah, but what's the next number after infinity? But at least it's very pleasant to read and just kind of unusually high quality for a kid's book. It's my top 1% or 0.5% of all kids' books.
I just pulled it up while you were talking to buy it. And one of the reviews just says, found it bizarre. Didn't read it to my 4-year-old. These concepts aren't done in what I would consider a comforting way.
Exactly.
So there's a counterpoint or maybe a further recommendation, depending on your preference.
I want discomfort.
Matt, how does it stack up to Dr. Seuss's And to Think I Saw It on Mulberry?
I don't think that I'm familiar with that text.
A little bit less racist?
That's one of the disappeared Seuss books that I assume that you were reading that over to your kids.
I'm not collecting the black market canceled books quite yet. I assume that at some point all like baseball cards will be canceled, and so therefore I will have a lot of and books.
You know, there's only one baseball card, right? The Billy Ripken card that was canceled, and that's the, you know, that's trading up there with Honus Wagner at this point in terms of value.
Those are all the valuations that we have time for here on the Reason podcast. Thank you for listening. Listen to all of our podcasts over at reason.com/not/, I've been told by listeners, podcasts. We will catch you again, even with fewer masks on, next Monday. Goodbye.